Welcome to Logos Live. I'm Robert Martin, Director of the City Bible Forum in Melbourne, and I'm your host for the show. Logos is Greek for word or message, and Logos Live usually engages the Christian message before a live audience in Melbourne. Yet today, our show isn't being recorded before a live audience. Instead, today, our show comes from the City Bible Forum office in the CBD of Melbourne. So today's episode's a bit like Logos pre-recorded, but nonetheless, I'm still sure you'll enjoy what we have in store. My guest today is John Hudson, and John has appeared on Logos Live before when we talked about suffering and the problem of evil. He was lead pastor of Melbourne Evangelical Church, but that's no longer the case. John, welcome back. Tell us, what are you doing now?
Thanks, Rob. Now, at the moment, I'm commencing a PhD on a theological synthesis of God's sovereignty and human responsibility.
Wow, that sounds like it's a bit of work.
Yeah, quite.
John, you've also got a particular interest in engaging atheists, agnostics, and skeptics. You've written blogs, you've spoken specifically engaging that particular group. Why is that?
Well, I feel that atheists and agnostics, particularly in the West, somewhere here like Melbourne, they really enjoy and thrive on reason. They really value reason and argument and evidence. And to me, that's exciting. That's an exciting claim. It means that we can have a conversation based on reason and evidence and argument and not, you know, defer to mystery or some other kind of mystical area, but we can have a discussion based on argument and evidence.
Yep, and you like arguing, do you?
Well, I love truth. Yeah. And that quite often leads me into arguments. But I love reason and logic.
Yeah.
And so on being able to have discussions on reason and logic and evidence is very exciting to me.
I mean, you were once an atheist yourself or something, yeah. I suppose. And so is there an element of empathy there that you have?
Yeah, there is. I think I can still understand the atheist mindset or, you know, the naturalism worldview. Mm-hmm. And I can still remember how I used to think as an atheist. So I have a soft spot, I guess, for atheists, for naturalists.
How was it that you used to think?
It's hard to kind of put into words. There's a number of different facets coming out of it. But I guess having science as the beacon of truth, mm-hmm. If something was scientific, everyone would go with it. If it wasn't, it was kind of in the area of opinion or speculation. I tended to write off other disciplines like history or philosophy or, you know, things that are, they're more speculative in area of opinion, whereas the facts, they're much more scientific.
And you like certainty, knowing things for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And I think I was very much raised as a scientist, so I love the pursuit of truth and science and reason.
Terrific. Now, it was also your experience of pastoring Melbourne Evangelical Church to engage these types of people, the atheists, skeptics, agnostics, etc. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, there's a lot of different things that happened. A lot of different people were engaged in different conversations about the gospel. I got in contact with the Secular Society at Melbourne University, had some very interesting and encouraging and fruitful conversations from that, a number of kind of challenges and objections that I hadn't really heard before and others that I had, and just engaging people from a whole bunch of different kind of walks of life, I guess. There was,
and you even did a debate once as well?
Yes, yes. I had a debate with the president of the Secular Society on the moral argument. We were debating the quote, "If God does not exist, everything is permitted." And I argued for that, and that kind of sparked some interesting discussion and conversation. And there was some, discussions and conversations that flowed from that and were ongoing as well.
And so what else happened? Is you engaging these types of people in the church?
Yeah, we had a 10-week series on the top 10 objections to Christianity. So we went through Melbourne, we asked 100 people what they think their strongest objection to Christianity is, and then we went through...
Sounds a bit like Family Feud.
A little bit, I guess, yeah. We're just interested to hear what people's thoughts were, where they're at, what, you know, stops people from embracing the gospel. And I remember there's one story where a girl at church brought her boyfriend along who wasn't a Christian, and his big objection to Christianity was, how could there be just one true religion? Mm-hmm. How do you know that your one true religion is right? All the others are wrong. There's so many. And the night that he came happened to be the night that I was speaking on the objection, there can't be just one true religion.
Wow. Yep.
And so he was quite engaged with that. We looked at the objection, at how it's often framed with the blind men and the elephants. Yep. All the different religions of the world are different blind men feeling the one elephant. And so they come to different articulations of it, but really they're all just looking at the one elephant. And I spoke about how Leslie Newbegin, when he was in India, he came across that a lot. And after thinking about that analogy for a while, he realized that actually, while it has an appearance of humility, it's actually quite an arrogant claim, because the only way you can make that claim is if you are the only one who sees the whole and everyone else only sees part. So you're saying, don't you say you have the whole, because I have the whole. The only way you can make that the only way the illustration can work is if you're the one who's not blind and everyone else is. So you're doing the very thing that you're forbidding everyone else from doing. And when you realize that, you understand that that objection fell away for him, at least. And not too long after that, he became a Christian.
Wow.
Yeah, so it can be quite fruitful engaging with these, you know, apologetic reasons, arguments, and objections.
Now, you're also writing a book with the working title Faith Based on Evidence. So why are you writing it?
Well, I guess one of the things that I came across again and again is an assumption that a lot of people make, that faith is the opposite of evidence. Either you have evidence for something or you have faith. If you don't have evidence for something, you need to take it on faith. Or,
well, I mean, some would say that the very title, Faith Based on Evidence, is oxymoronic. Mm. It contradicts itself. In fact, well, world-famous atheist Richard Dawkins once claimed that faith is blind trust in the absence of evidence, even in the teeth of evidence. So how can you be writing a book on faith based on evidence if faith doesn't require evidence?
Yeah, so I think there's certainly a kernel of truth in that there can be blind faith. Like, blind faith is in the absence of evidence, or in the teeth of evidence, if you will. But Christian faith, at least as I understand it, is not blind faith at all. Mm-hmm. It's faith based on evidence. The way the Bible uses the word faith, or fide, in the Greek New Testament, it's communicating trust and reliance and dependence. And that's not without evidence. We have evidence for it, but it's more of a relational term, trusting in the God who we have evidence for, as opposed to a blind trust without any evidence, or even against the evidence.
Mm. What is faith then? You've alluded to it being trusting or something. What is faith?
Well, I think the way that the Bible uses it, it's a relational term. You have faith in a person. So I have, for example, a lot of faith in my wife. And that faith is based on evidence. From the evidence that what I know of her, what I've seen of her actions in the past, I have faith that she won't let me down, that she'll continue to love me and support me and look after our children. I have great trust and reliance and dependence on her because of the evidence that I've seen from her. Mm. And I think it's our relationship with God is like that. We don't kind of trust in this being who we have absolutely no evidence for. We do have a lot of evidence, I think, for the Christian faith, and we're trusting God on that evidence.
And so what specifically motivates you to write this book then?
I really want to expose this assumption that faith is the opposite to evidence. I think sometimes it might be. There are, I think, a number of people who do have blind faith in things, but I want to make it clear that Christian faith, at least thoughtful Christian faith, is really not against or contrary to evidence. I think the evidence actually favors Christianity, and naturalism is, in a sense, without evidence. It's largely an assumption that can't be verified or falsified, whereas I think Christianity, at least for me, it's not an assumption. It's much more of a conclusion based on the evidence. And that's the actual thesis of the book, is not just that it's a false dichotomy between evidence and faith, but rather that the evidence actually points towards Christianity rather than away from it.
Just to clarify, when you mean naturalism, you mean that atheism? How do you understand the relationship between naturalism and atheism?
Yeah, great question. I think naturalism is a subset of atheism, so you can be an atheist and not a naturalist. But if you're a naturalist, you really are an atheist. I think naturalism is the worldview that holds that there is the natural, but there's no supernatural.
Right.
So there's no supernatural realities. There's only what there is in nature, and we can observe that and understand it through science. And that, to me, seems to be a very much an atheistic worldview, though you could be an atheist and not a naturalist. You could believe in something beyond nature that's not God.
Popular atheist author and neuroscientist Sam Harris claims that there is no evidence for religious propositions. He wrote, "Every religion preaches the truth of propositions for which it has no evidence." So what would you say to Sam Harris?
Yeah, I think I can understand why a man like Sam Harris would say that and want to argue that. I think, though, the argument really works both ways. So I think there is no worldview that can be proven. Every worldview is a set of assumptions that kind of helps us to explain and interpret the world around us. Mm-hmm. And they don't all have to stay assumptions, of course. When, you know, they're confirmed by the evidence, they become more concretely held, I guess. And I think there actually is quite a lot of evidence for a God in general and for the God revealed in the Bible in particular. But I think also That same test of, you know, where is the evidence for your worldview, that isn't only applied to religious worldviews. I think that can be applied to atheistic worldviews like naturalism. Where is this evidence that there is only the natural and there is no supernatural? I think quite often atheists like Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, those kind of people, can quite often assume that their worldview is true. Assume it's almost like their worldview wins by default. If your arguments for your religion don't convince me, then naturalism wins by default. I want to say, why does that win by default? What evidence do you have that there is no supernatural realities, that there is only the natural? I think if you're going to make that claim of naturalism, which I think naturalism is a positive claim, then I can just as easily ask you, what do you base that on? Where is your reason, evidence, and argument for naturalism?
A naturalist would often respond by just saying, well, there's no evidence for God.
Well, first of all, I think there is. But even if I grant that there isn't, how do you then go from, well, I don't know, to there is no God? I think there's a step there. There's a number of agnostics who aren't atheists and want to distance themselves from atheists. And I think confusing atheism and agnosticism is essentially special pleading on the burden of proof. I think the burden of proof applies to all claims, claims about the existence of aliens and claims about the non-existence of aliens. If you say an alien exists, well, what do you base that on? You can put them under the burden of proof. If you say no aliens exist, I can ask, what do you base that on? The same burden of proof applies. The only one who is exempt from the burden of proof is the one who says, I don't know. And I think agnosticism really is the position that wins by default. But I think naturalism is going a step further. So there are agnostics like Bart Ehrmond and Mike Dobbins, who are agnostics but distance themselves from atheism. In fact, Mike Dobbins, who's an agnostic, wrote a book called The Case Against Atheism. I don't think you can call him an atheist. And so by saying that, things like, you hear phrases like agnosticism is under the umbrella of atheism, which is really confusing the two. I think that it's really special pleading on the burden of proof. You're trying to impose your categories that don't fit the evidence. We see evidence where there are agnostics who are not atheists, and when your categories don't fit the evidence, I think you need to change your categories, and that's good. That's called learning.
Well, let's think about some of the evidence for God. So what would you say is evidence for belief in God?
Yeah, great question. Hypotheses are accepted when they explain what we observe, and they're rejected when they explain away or deny what we observe. That's how scientific reasoning works. That's how reason in general works. So if you're a doctor and you're diagnosing a patient, if your diagnosis explains all the symptoms, then it's much more likely if there's other symptoms it doesn't explain, or there's, you know, symptoms that wouldn't be there with your diagnosis, then there's a problem. Similarly, if you're a detective trying to solve a crime, if your hypothesis can explain all the evidence and all the clues, then it's much more likely. Whereas if there's things that fly in the face of it, if there, you know, someone has an alibi or something, then it's not as strong. So I think both scientific reasoning and reasoning in general, if you can explain the evidence, then it's a much stronger case. And this kind of, it's called abductive reasoning. It's inference to the best explanation. And so I think there's a number of pieces of evidence that are best explained by the worldview of Christian theism rather than other worldviews, especially naturalism. And I have five that I talk about in the book. They are the origin of the universe, the fine-tuning of the universe, the origin of life from non-life, the ubiquitous pursuit of objective morality, and the resurrection-shaped whole in first century history.
Wow, okay. Well, we probably haven't got time to go through all of those in great detail, but tell us about a couple of them. Which ones do you find persuasive?
I guess it depends who I'm talking to, really. I like to use different ones with different people, depending on which connect with them, which ones speak to them. Some people kind of dismiss others. I wouldn't necessarily bring that up as the first one. For me, though, I think the historicity of the resurrection, or the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, I think that's got quite a lot of evidence behind it. People have been trying to overturn it for 2,000 years, and it's really stood up to scrutiny. And I think it's kind of unique in that it gets you all the way to Christianity. The other pieces of evidence kind of point towards theism rather than atheism, but this one, it's a particular theism that's Christian theism.
Maybe let's talk a bit about the moral argument, as you've debated that before. So the ubiquitous pursuit of objective morality, what's that? How does that point us towards the God being there?
Objective morality, and that is morality that is not opinion, but like objective moral facts, I think fit much better within a theistic worldview rather than an atheistic worldview. I think quite often this argument is misheard, and atheists hear me and other Christians saying you need God in order to be good.
Not have morals.
Yeah, or, you know, we as if atheists don't have morals. Of course atheists have morals. I think my argument doesn't deny that. In fact, it kind of depends on that.
Yeah.
It depends on their sense of morality. So I think that there's a difference between moral feelings and moral obligation. So a moral feeling is, I think X is good, I'm going to do X. I think Y is bad, I'm going to do Y. But a moral obligation is you ought to do X or you're not permitted to do Y, regardless of your own moral feelings. And I think if that is the case, that there is an objective morality that's not person-dependent, it's not subjective on our opinions, then what objective standard are you pointing to adjudicate between your moral feelings and the moral feelings of people who disagree with you? Or are you just saying that your moral feelings are superior? I really feel that argument has had a lot of interest, and people have been reading and writing on it for quite a long time, especially in recent decades. And I'm yet to find a satisfying answer within an atheistic framework. If there is a God and he has revealed to us what is good, then I think that is an objective standard. So, for example, Martin Luther King, when he was experiencing a lot of persecution, he was sent to jail for peacefully protesting against segregation in the American South. He wrote a letter from Birmingham jail that said, "How do you know if a law is a moral law or not, or if it's an immoral law? Well, if it accords with the word of God, then it's moral, and if it's out of accord with the word of God, then it's immoral." And I think that's a strong basis for morality. And I know a lot of atheists and skeptics who have a lot of problems with that, and that raises a whole bunch of questions about the Bible. But at least he's being consistent. At least he's saying, look, this is something that I can point to that adjudicates between my moral feelings and your moral feelings. Mm. Whereas I think if there is no written word, there is no holy word from God, all there is you know, what I say versus what you say, or versus what they say in another country, then what objective standard do we have for saying we're right about this issue and you're wrong about this issue? And I think this is a real issue. Like, you see, you know, countries where there's still slavery, or the caste system in India, or other countries where women are being oppressed, and we kind of feel an outrage against that, and we want to say, no, you ought to have Western individualism, you ought to treat all people equally, all these kind of things, and they quite often turn around and say, why? Says who?
Well, exactly right. I mean, because if there is no objective standard, then it's your will against theirs.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's whoever has the might is right, I suppose, at that particular point.
Quite often, yeah. It's our moral feelings versus their moral feelings. And quite often it's might make right. Sometimes some will argue for the majority rule. So if the majority of people in a certain country say it's okay, then it's okay. The problem is there are countries where the majority vote to oppress women, or to have slavery, or to, you know, and
or to put Jews in gas chambers.
Yeah, yeah, terrible examples like that. And then our moral feelings say, no, that doesn't just feel wrong, that is wrong. Mm. And I think there is a ubiquitous pursuit of objective morality. Every single culture, right from the beginning of time, well, from recorded history at least, has always sought to codify and enforce some kind of law. We've always sought to, you know, maintain and hold people to account, where we say you can't do this, and if you do it, then we're going to punish you somehow.
Mm. But I mean, some atheists that I've engaged with have said that, well, maybe there is no objective morality. It is just might is right. It's just whatever the majority says.
Yeah, there are. There are certainly a number of moral relativists who would say that. Though I'd still like to appeal to the ubiquitous pursuit of objective morality. You know, every culture has always sought to establish, maintain, and enforce law, which is moral obligation, which is you ought to do this and you are not permitted to do that. And if you do, then we're going to, you know, our big group of people who are going to call police, we're going to come and we're going to punish you somehow. That's not relativism. There is an objective morality that we think is wrong. And I think deep down, I know there are a number of people who would claim relativism and that kind of thing, but I've never met a person who, when real injustice happened to them, they didn't say, that's wrong.
Mm.
No one at that, when push comes to shove, says, oh, you know, my family's just been murdered and I feel that that's wrong. No, they say, no, that is wrong and justice needs to be done. And so I think deep down we feel it, though quite often they still want to deny it. And okay, if you're going to deny it, I'd like to point to the sociological evidence for the ubiquitous pursuit of objective morality. That's, I think, falsifiable evidence.
So how did it go in your debate then, when you talked about this? How did the dialogue go when you presented this argument?
Yes. It was an interesting debate. My interlocutor from the Secular Society, he pointed to a philosopher by the name of Railton, who said, well, what if there was someone who was ideally rational, and then what they said was right or wrong was right or wrong. So he wasn't a moral relativist. He said, yes, okay, there is objective morality. So what do you do when you disagree? Well, what if there was this ideally rational person who was...
sort of like a God man.
Well, an unjudged judge, at least, who could, you know, tell us what is right and wrong, and we can listen to him. And I said, well, the problem is no one has access to this ideally rational person. Who is this? Who's going to claim to be ideally rational? What if we disagree with him? And so my question, what objective standard are you pointing to adjudicate between your moral feelings and my moral feelings, or are you claiming yours are superior, can just be tweaked a little bit to expose the fallaciousness of that argument. What objective standard are you pointing to adjudicate between what you think an ideally rational person would say and what I think an ideally rational person would say? Or are you just saying your feelings about what they would say are superior? The argument still holds. You still don't have an objective basis. You just kind of have this hypothetical that doesn't really help us.
But that didn't persuade everyone that you were doing the debate.
Well, actually, I think not everyone, of course, but I think it did shake up some feathers. There were some people who realized that, well, maybe that my atheism isn't as secure and all-powerfully explaining of everything as I thought.
Right.
There were a number of people who raised other objections that I dealt with and had, you know, fruitful conversations over a period of time. But I feel like on this argument, there were a number of thoughtful atheists really engaging and... not able to bring great counter-arguments against it.
Well, we mentioned before the resurrection of Jesus, so maybe we should go there now to talk about the evidence from that. As you said, that is the most persuasive for you. And as part of Logos Live, we do reflect on the scriptures, the Logos, and today we reflect on a passage from the Gospel of John. John is one of the four biographies of Jesus' life that we have, and John 14:11 says, "Believe me when I say that I am in the Father, and the Father is in me, or at least believe on the evidence of the works themselves." So, John, in this passage here speaks of evidence. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I think it's Jesus saying, you don't just have to take my word for it. It's not blind faith in me.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the evidence. Look, it's kind of like when some people from John the Baptist came to Jesus and said, should we expect someone else? He says, look at what you see. You know, the blind see, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the good news is proclaimed to the poor. It's faith based on Jesus, but it's not blind faith. It's because of the works that Jesus does. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately, the ultimate work of Jesus is the resurrection. And if the resurrection really happened, then I think we have to listen to Jesus. We have to listen to what he says about God. We have to listen to what he says about the Word of God, which is the Bible. We have to listen to what he says about us.
Hmm.
Unless you can explain the resurrection without invoking God rose Jesus from the dead, I think his explanation and the explanation of the disciples that God raised Jesus from the dead is the best explanation, which has a whole series of implications.
So it seems that you're saying that this passage indicates that Jesus doesn't expect people to believe in him with blind trust in the absence of evidence or even in the teeth of evidence?
Yes, very much so. And I think it's quite dangerous if you do have blind faith. If you don't think through your faith, if you don't think through why you believe, it can become quite dangerous. If you're engaged with someone who's quite hostile to Christianity, or especially in a Western culture that's becoming more and more hostile to Christianity, your faith can be shaken much more easily. It's kind of a insecure faith. It's not as robust as it could be. Whereas I think if you pursue your doubts and if you really, you know, get to the bottom of them, then it can make for a much more robust faith if you think it through and see the evidence that it's based on.
So this passage also talks about believing the evidence of the works themselves. Now, you mentioned the resurrection as one of the key works, but Jesus hasn't been resurrected at this point. So what are the works that Jesus wants people to base their belief in?
I think at the time that Jesus said that in John 14, he's talking about his miracles, the miracles that he's been doing. He's been healing the blind. He's been opening the ears of the deaf. He's been raising the dead, as he did in John chapter 11, just three chapters earlier. So it's how do you explain that unless he is from God? It's a pretty big question. I think even his enemies at the time, they didn't say that Jesus is doing no miracles. They attributed his miracles to Satan. Mm-hmm. So they weren't denying that he was doing these incredible works, but they had to offer an alternate explanation. So I think today when people have objections against the miracles that Jesus does or did, they're not, I don't think, following the evidence of what Jesus has done. They're kind of explaining away the evidence because of their assumption that miracles are impossible because there is no God.
But surely believing as a result of a miracle is less reliable than believing on the basis of something more certain, like science, for example.
I don't think so, no. I think science is brilliant, and I love science, and I have a degree in science, and I want to promote it. But at the same time, I don't think it necessarily explains everything. It kind of, it works on the assumption of the regularity of nature, but that doesn't entail naturalism. It kind of entails methodological naturalism, if you like. You have to work on the assumption that miracles are miraculous. But how do you go from miracles are miraculous to miracles are impossible?
Mm.
From methodological naturalism to philosophical naturalism? That's a jump. That's a leap. And I want to ask, okay, you're going to make that jump. Okay, why? What did you base it on? What's your reasoning? What's your evidence from going that miracles are miraculous to miracles are impossible?
So say you've been listening today, you're an atheist or an agnostic, and you've not really been persuaded by the evidence you've been presented to so far. What would you say to them?
I'd like to say, okay, sure. What evidence do you have for your worldview? What do you base your reasoning on? What do you believe about God, and why do you believe it? I think ultimately it's very important for your views to be shaped by the evidence rather than shape the evidence to fit your view. If you're shaping the evidence to fit your view, it's an obvious confirmation bias. And then, you know, what evidence could persuade you that you're wrong if you're shaping it all to fit your view? So I think stay open as best you can. Try to see your confirmation bias and correct it or account for it at least. And I think be open to the evidence. I really think that there is scientific evidence that the universe had a beginning, scientific evidence that the universe is fine-tuned, a scientific fact that life came from non-life. We have no idea how that could have happened naturally. We're only just realizing how hard the problem is. Real sociological evidence for the ubiquitous pursuit of objective morality, and real historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And I think that all points to and is explained really well by Christian theism, and is, as far as I can tell, continuously explained away and denied by worldviews like naturalism.
Thank you so much, John. It's been a pleasure. Let me leave you with the Logos for the day. John 14:11. Believe me when I say that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or at least believe on the evidence of the works themselves. I look forward to you joining us next time for Logos Live. Thank you to our guest today, John Hudson.
Thank you.